From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The credit crisis, foreclosures, the weak dollar, inflation. The headlines this week were dominated by the economy. Amid all the turmoil, the part of the story most obvious to most Americans is the price of oil, and more particularly, the price of gasoline at the pump. The media, therefore, have spent a lot of time dealing with the oil price bubble, often framing it as an issue of supply and demand.
First of all, from economics, we know that there's supply and demand. We are not going to solve the oil problem without dealing with both the supply problem, which means drilling,
very well might lower demand for energy prices. We can't do much in the near term about supply. We can do a lot about the demand.
A bigger collapse in demand, and we'll see lower prices for sure.
It's down $18. Why? It all comes down to the basic law of supply and demand.
But Howell Raines, media columnist for Portfolio Magazine and former executive editor for the New York Times, says journalists generally haven't been asking the right questions about oil prices.
The oil companies have gotten away with a very simplistic explanation that this is purely supply and demand, and they cast themselves as helpless victims of supply and demand. We have a supply crunch because of a calculated decision on their part to, one, cut back on exploration, two, close half of the refineries that we had only a few years ago, and three, to redirect all of their spending from things like research and development into profits. So none of these things are unpredictable or accidental.
Now, in your piece and portfolio, you portray us as kind of unwitting victims to the superior public relations tactics of the oil companies in particular. You focused on poor Matt Lauer, who has often invited the chairman of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, onto the program. And you say that Lauer just gets played for a chump.
What I actually did was give Matt credit for gamely asking questions. The problem is that in a five-minute format, he's up against a PR superstar in Rex Tillerson.
This is a demand-driven price run-up, no question about it. I think all of your viewers are well aware of the rapidly growing economies in China, India, other parts of the world. And with those rapidly growing economies, tens of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty. That's a good thing. The negative effect is there's huge demand on energy, and that's put a lot of pressure on the price.
For them to depict supply and demand as if it was as inevitable as gravity and as random as lightning is simply asking us to take a very naive view of business practices.
Has no reporter worked that story?
No, there have been a number of excellent series starting about 5 years ago with Bartlett and Steele, the Pulitzer-winning team from Time Magazine. And other papers have done good work in this area. You know, one of the real problems of any reporting any complex subject is that every story can't be a complete explanation of the whole subject matter. Once my column came out, I got an email from an energy reporter in Texas, the heart of the oil patch, saying that her editors were only interested in stories about consumer price rather than stories that raised these fundamental questions. You know, one of the real problems of any reporting any complex subject is that every story can't be a complete explanation of the whole subject matter.
You make an assertion early in your piece that this generation of reporters, unlike, let's say, your generation and mine, are children of Reaganomics and not of kind of the FDR ethic that so informed journalism, let's say, up until the 80s.
We're all creatures of our moment in history and our larger society. The cultural ethos that flowed out of the Depression and World War II was one that was very challenging toward the prerogatives of corporations. The business culture that took root in the Reagan administration is one in which the idea that taxes are evil has become deeply entrenched, and the idea that corporate prerogatives ought not to be regulated. So I'm saying that there is a less challenging mentality in the press as a whole than there was 40 years ago. And let me say that I did not envision my column as a blanket condemnation of the press, but as commentary on how we need here a more vigorous journalism that's less relaxed about corporate public relations.
So, well, you've said now that you didn't mean to condemn an entire industry for its coverage of the oil crisis. You came just short of that. What would you propose for every daily newspaper and other media organization in covering this story?
Well, I think right now it's very important to examine the research and development and exploration figures. If you look at the fact that 80% of the lands under lease are not explored, then that casts a whole new light on two primary oil company claims. One, that supply and demand is purely driven by momentary market forces that they can't control. And the other argument that falls apart is that they need ANWR.
When you say ANWR, you're talking about the Arctic Wildlife Refuge?
Yeah, right. There's simply no way that ANWR would come online in time to have any price impact, and indeed any long-term impact on the problem that we're facing as a society and as a world culture, which is to use the dwindling resources from petroleum to find the energy sources for tomorrow. And, you know, there are lovely pictures of windmill farms on the advertising, but if you look at the statistical information, the oil companies have made a decision to divert money not into exploration, research, and infrastructure development, but into profits. This is not illegal, but it is good to be honest about it.
Hal, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Hal Raines is contributing editor and media columnist for Portfolio Magazine.
The price of oil is one story where the media gets stuck on a couple of key words, in that case, supply and demand. Healthcare reform is another such issue. If Barack Obama is elected president, he says he'll push for a national healthcare plan or even a universal plan.
We are going to pass a universal healthcare bill. It is long overdue. The time is ripe.
The media have also called his plan national or universal. Trudy Lieberman says they should stop because it isn't. Lieberman, who's director of the Health and Medical Reporting Program at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism, has been covering the coverage of the healthcare debate in the Columbia Journalism Review. She says that the words national and universal have specific meanings when applied to healthcare plans. Basically, they refer to plans that already exist in Europe where
everybody is covered. Everybody's entitled to care because they are citizens of those countries. And everybody pays for them through a various system of taxes. What we have here in this country is the candidates have tried to shoehorn those labels onto their own proposals, which means something very different.
And what does that mean?
Essentially, what Obama would like to do is craft a plan that builds on private insurance coverage from Aetna, Cigna, Blue Cross, and the like, and add to that a public program, a national insurance exchange people might be able to go to and buy coverage. If this entity, this health insurance exchange, works, then people will have another option. Let me say what the lead of an AP story was that I think came very close to describing what Obama is doing, that Obama was proposing universal access to coverage. Access is the key word, as opposed to automatic coverage as a matter of right.
Is the press getting this wrong because the Obama campaign also misuses these words? The Obama webpage says that, quote, Obama will make available a new national health plan to all Americans.
I think that's campaign rhetoric. There have been a number of things Obama has said, including that he doesn't take money from lobbyists, and we've talked a lot about that at CJR. And so I think there's a tendency to play fast and loose with the words, and I think that's the case here.
Now, you've also been critical of press coverage of John McCain's health care proposal, but for very different reasons. Spell out the bottom line there for us.
Basically, McCain wants you to pay taxes on the employer-provided insurance that you get. And when that happens, he's going to give tax credits to people, $5,000 for families, $2,500 for individuals, to go into the individual market to buy their own coverage. It's likely young, healthy people will leave the employer plan and go into this individual market, leaving only the sick people left in the boss's insurance, and that will send the premiums through the roof. What this will do eventually is force a large crack in the employer-provided insurance market, And ultimately, people will have to go to the individual market to buy their coverage.
So you say that the true implications of McCain's health plan have not been covered, have been woefully undercovered?
There's been very, very little coverage of it. There's been a line or two that says McCain's plan is very radical because it could begin to break up the employer market. And that's as far as it goes. So there needs to be a lot more explanation and exploration about what this is going to mean down the road.
So why do you think the press has fallen down on all of this? Is it just too complicated?
It's very complicated. I think the best thing for reporters to do is to find some very good experts and sit down with them. And I think there's the feeling among editors that people really don't want to sit and read a long story or hear a long story.
That's quite an indictment.
About these very important proposals. Some people are certainly looking to the internet for more information about this, and the blogosphere is full of it, and some of it's pretty good.
Who do you think is doing this story well?
We have seen a lack of coverage of what these proposals actually mean to people. And I have pointed out that a blogger for Glamour magazine came the closest to doing that, and she put her own healthcare situation in terms of the candidates' proposals and found that she wouldn't do very well under any of them.
Trudy, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Trudy Lieberman is the director of the Health and Medical Reporting Program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. She's covering the healthcare debate for the Columbia Journalism Review.
Up next, a conversation with the new publisher of The Washington Post, and a reader sues his local paper for fraud.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In this week's newspaper apocalypse roundup, Gannett's quarterly profits were down 36%. The Atlanta Constitution cut 8% of its workforce. The editor of the Chicago Tribune quit. The publisher of the LA Times resigned under pressure. And the New York Post and New York Daily News, the itchy and scratchy of tabloid rivalry, discussed cooperating on production to cut costs. The Washington Post somehow stayed out of the dreary headlines for once, but amid declines in circulation and revenues and dramatic staffing cuts, it hasn't much lately. Presiding over the future of the Post in these turbulent times is publisher Catherine Weymouth, the granddaughter of the legendary Catherine Graham. Weymouth has been at the Post front office in various capacities for 12 years, but landed this plum job 6 months ago, smack dab in the middle of the industry's tailspin. Catherine, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
Print circulation is down. Craigslist pretty much killed the classified ad business. The online product brings in vast new audience, but no vast new revenue. I guess because the ad rates commanded for online content are pennies on the dollar next to your print rates. Can you please give me a sketch of how all of this has affected the Post's financial situation?
I mean, there's no question these are daunting times and we are not immune. And particularly this year with the economy, as well as all the competition, revenues are down significantly. We had hoped to see this year tick up a little bit, but obviously it hasn't, and I expect next year to be tough as well.
It's often said that maybe the days of the 30% profit margins are over in the industry, but it's still a very profitable business. It has been rumored, though, that your newspaper business, not the whole company, but the newspaper operation, is borderline unprofitable. Is that true?
Well, we're releasing our earnings in a couple of weeks, and I'm not going to talk about them before they're released.
I can presume that there's nothing we should be deliriously excited over in the offing, however?
No, I mean, I think there's no question that it's been a tough year, and the numbers will reflect that.
Understanding that the web is still in its infancy, nobody has figured out yet how to make any money there, at least any substantial money. The slogan I hear so often is, we have the audience, all we need is a business model. Do you have any hope that any such business model will emerge?
I do have hope. I mean, I think it's a very different business from the newspaper. and we're all experimenting, but we do see double-digit growth every year in our advertising revenues, and we see audience growth every year. And in general, where there's an audience, there are advertisers that want to reach that audience.
You at the Post have a luxury of two classes of stock, most of it within the family and close associates. Has that insulated you from the pressures that have so afflicted Knight Ridder and Gannett, the previous incarnation of the Tribune Company, and other media corporations that are so utterly answerable to Wall Street?
Well, I think it's less the stock structure, although that plays a role, and more that the company overall, thanks in large part to our education division and cable and a little bit our TV stations, is doing well. So that does cushion the pressure for us a little bit, but it doesn't mean we don't have to stand on our own 2 feet, because we do.
The education business you refer to is Kaplan, which is an SAT prep and online higher education company. Has that become a more significant financial force than the Post's newspaper operation itself?
Yeah, it's more than half of the Post company's revenues at this point, and it's growing, and it's a tremendous company. But I leave the hard questions about the overall performance of the company to my uncle Don, because he's running it.
Okay. That's Donald Graham, the CEO of the Washington Post Company. The Washington Post is and has been one of the great newspapers of the world. Its newsroom, however, has just lost a whole lot of institutional memory, some unbelievable talent, and more than 100 souls. I wonder about the Post's path as a great newspaper. For how long can we assume that the paper that I get on my doorstep every morning is going to be the Washington Post as I've come to expect it?
We still have 700 people in this newsroom, give or take 100 people. I think if you said to me, take 800 incredibly talented journalists and put out a terrific newspaper and a great website and a great mobile product, that we can do that and that we do that. We certainly lost a lot of colleagues and we were sorry to see them go, but we still have incredible talent.
Sam Zell, who took over the Tribune Company, has flown around the company creating animosity at almost every stop, largely by telling his own employees that many of them are irrelevant and that they're missing the point of what they do for a living. And they hate him. They don't hate you at the Post. Even though the circumstances that you're in are approximately the same as Zell's, how have you managed to remain the apple of your employees' eye?
Well, I don't know if I'm the apple of their eye, but maybe because I've only been in this job for a little over 5 months, I guess. I'm sure over time there will be people who won't like things that I do or oversee. And I can't really comment on the Tribune situation. They're actually, I think, in a quite different situation, particularly given the debt they have. But I think also our employees understand that times are tough and that we have to shrink and we have to cut costs, and we're going to still make every effort to provide our readers the best products we can. So I think people get it.
Catherine, I'm given to low-level depression. Tell me something, anything about your first 6 months on the job that will make me feel better about the journalism world I live in.
I guess I think there's a lot of hope, right? I mean, you know, 600,000 people every single day buy our paper, and that's the actual physical copy. We have 9 million unique visitors every month on the web. You know, my daughter, who's 8, is reading books on the Kindle. And I went on vacation a week ago, and I took the Kindle with me because I couldn't get the Washington Post. And I read the Washington Post every day on the Kindle. I mean, I think the world is changing, but we've seen movies go through this. We're seeing music go through this. Other industries have evolved and survived to see another day, and I think we will be one of them.
Well, Catherine, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Catherine Weymouth is the publisher of the Washington Post. Months ago, the Associated Press busted a website called The Drudge Retort, not to be confused with the more famous Drudge Report, for doing what countless websites do, posting short excerpts from and linking to stories by the Associated Press. The reaction in the blogosphere was fast and furious. Drudge Retort owner Rogers Cadenhead did take down the posts. The AP told him that he could repost them if he made some alterations. Those weren't made public, but he declined. That was the end of that particular skirmish, but the AP didn't announce any kind of guidelines for use of their material, and the battle over copyright and fair use on the web rages on. Siva Vaidyanathan, author of Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity, says mainstream news organizations have largely retreated on this issue.
For years, there have been sort of little hints that news organizations were going to take some action about this. Back in the beginning of this decade, there were a number of efforts by papers like the New York Times and the LA Times to sort of cleanse discussion sites of their content. But, you know, pretty soon the lawyers for those organizations realized that they were pretty much causing more trouble than it was worth. The cash value of this behavior in an individual sense is not very much.
So AP, a juggernaut, takes on a website that, you know, has like 8,500 users. What's going on here?
You know, the AP is, I think, legitimately concerned that its clients that pick up and pay for AP content are perhaps being displaced by these news aggregator sites, places where one can go to find a bunch of interesting AP stories. So AP's lawyers were very interested in making an example out of this guy, carving out policy for how bloggers should actually handle copyrighted material like this. In this case, AP is sort of standing in for the traditional news industry in general. You know, AP has a stake in the financial health of newspapers in Detroit and Tulsa and Sacramento, as well as the health of Yahoo News.
The internet has taken a very liberal view of what constitutes fair use. I mean, there is a body of thought that all content wants to be free, which essentially ignores ownership rights of any kind. I'm curious to know what you think a proper balance should be.
You know, you pick up just enough to make your point. You pick up enough text to get to the gist of the story to which you're referring. You pick up the controversial part of a statement that you want to criticize. You make sure to embed it within a larger conversation of commentary. And all of that is classic fair use. So most bloggers in most situations are actually, whether they know it or not, behaving according to the core principles of fair use. And that's because fair use really does ultimately depend on common sense industry standards.
I want to ask you about AP's hardline position. I gather it has softened somewhat since the controversy originally erupted.
Late last month, they ended up reaching some sort of agreement through which no one will sue anybody, fortunately, and no one will therefore be out a ton of money regardless of the settlement. But also, I think just as importantly to everybody, no court will decide what is fair use in the blogosphere. And that was one of those things that no side could predict the result of. So everyone's sort of relieved in that sense. But what's really interesting is it seems from all that I've read coming out of that agreement, that what AP would really like is for bloggers to refrain from quoting the headline and the first paragraph of AP stories. In other words, that lead paragraph in sort of journalism 101 terms, the nut graph. AP seems to be saying that the basic facts of the story in its simplest possible language are what is valuable of the story. But in fact, copyright doesn't protect facts or ideas ever. So you end up in this weird paradoxical situation where AP is trying to protect what is actually least protectable about what it does.
This whole issue gets to the odd symbiosis between mainstream media and the blogosphere, because the media needs the blogosphere to create more audience, and the blogosphere needs the mainstream media to have the raw material upon which to aggregate, fulminate, bloviate. But in order for that to happen, the raw material has to have a business model attached to it. Do you believe that the AP really is in jeopardy from the Drudge retorts of the world?
We're starting to get a sense at this point, 10, 12 years into the age of the World Wide Web, that there's no zero sum here. That in fact, there are ways that your paid for ad supported work can echo through the free media spaces and benefit you. And there certainly can be huge leaks in the system that can perhaps detract from revenue you thought you deserved at some point. But, you know, it's not simple arithmetic, and we're still sort of feeling our way through it.
Okay, Siva, thank you as always.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
Siva Vaidyanathan is the author of Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity, and a professor of media studies and law at the University of Virginia.
News organizations, editors, and bloggers all are dealing with the financial difficulties newspapers face. But what about readers? What recourse have they if they're upset with a paper's efforts to downsize? They could write a letter, cancel their subscription, or even sue? That's the line of attack chosen by a newspaper reader in Durham, North Carolina. Attorney Keith Hempstead recently filed a lawsuit against his local paper, the News and Observer, and its parent company, McClatchy Newspapers, after they laid off 70 employees and announced cuts to the news pages. He says he's mad, and he's not going to take it anymore.
I'm suing because I am upset with the state of the newspaper industry in general, and I feel like I can represent subscribers to the various McClatchy newspapers that are frankly upset with the state of the industry and how it's being run.
But what's the charge?
The charge in this case is fraud. I'm stating or alleging that when I renewed my newspaper subscription, I was relying upon a superior product. But with these cuts that were announced after I renewed the newspaper, I feel like I'm getting the short end of the stick. I liken it to someone who buys a ticket to go cross country on an airline. And the airline announces that they instead will be flying only to Denver versus, say, Los Angeles. Well, I am able to take a flight, but it's not to my intended destination.
Forgive me here, but most unsatisfied readers would just cancel their subscription. Why did you decide to take the legal route?
Because I realize, as a former newspaper reporter, that canceling a single subscription doesn't really send a point to the newspaper. I feel like this is a way of firing a shot across the bow of the newspaper industry.
Now, you've said this lawsuit isn't about the money, but you are suing for an unspecified amount of damages and attorney's fees. Now, in the unlikely chance that you would actually win this case,
and it is highly unlikely,
wouldn't you be doing your paper more harm than good?
The point is to get the attention of the industry. I'm hoping at least that this will create some discussion within the upper management, as well as within the industry in general, and hopefully amongst other readers. I'm sure that there are plenty of other readers that feel like me.
Now, you've made this shot across the bow. How do you really expect this lawsuit to play out?
It will be most likely resolved in the next week or two. You know, most suits that are filed never actually go before a jury. They're settled one way or another. What I am hoping for is at least an opportunity to really speak to management and to have an opportunity to maybe write an op-ed piece to show the frustration of newspaper readers in general. At the same time, I have been in contact with the law firm of national prominence that is at least looking at the possibility of pursuing the lawsuit.
Now, if you could actually take a meeting with upper management rather than just suing them, what's your main beef? What do you think they're doing wrong in the face of an industry in so much turmoil?
They are destroying their principal product. And if they're hoping that they will be able to adapt to the internet age with a new business model, then they are deceiving themselves, because by the time they are able to come to a new business model, they will no longer have any reporters to actually cover the news. It boggles the mind that these great businesses are destroying themselves within. And I realized that most of those people who work in these newspapers are afraid to speak up because their job might be next. Someone has to speak out for them.
Keith, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Keith Hempstead is a former news reporter, also a real estate developer and a real estate attorney.
Coming up, do you have a right to learn about your genes without a doctor's note? And scientific theory is obsolete. Pass it on.
This is On the Media from NPR.
For NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose knowledge center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, all week, everyone in the media was looking like they ate a bug, just like Kathy Lee Gifford and Hata Kotb on the Today Show.
Satire's supposed to be funny. If you have to explain it to everybody,
right.
Oh, here it is.
Here
How
it
funny
is
it?
Cover. Yeah, yeah. I don't like it very much, and I think
it's horrible.
Sure there. Yeah,
I think it's horrible.
Yeah. So why are we showing
well,
it?
Well, I don't know, because everybody's talking about it.
There is no less euphonious sound on earth than the media getting their collective knickers in a twist over something done by the media, especially when all those outraged pundits who make good livings off our rancorous marketplace of ideas decide they have to protect us from a joke. The New Yorker cover sought to satirize all the nasty lies about Obama on which the very media now protesting too much have fed for months. When New Yorker editor David Remnick went on the Charlie Rose show this week, he took along a clip from The Daily Show as his best defense, fighting media, I suppose, with media. And he was right to do so, because here's what Jon Stewart said about what the Obama campaign should have said.
Barack Obama is in no way upset about the cartoon that depicts him as a Muslim extremist, because you know who gets upset about cartoons? Muslim extremists.
The cover kerfuffle is an old story by now and probably not worth mentioning, except that it scared the hell out of me. Because either our airwaves are populated by Muslim extremists or by people who think we're all a bunch of idiots. Actually, when you think about it, that explains a lot. At the frontier of retail medicine, there are a few ideas that are as seductive as genetic testing. Send in a little saliva or a few hairs, pay a few $1,000s, and get back a kind of genetic horoscope, what you might expect from your genetic destiny. Heaps of companies now offer variations of this service, most of them over the web, but being at the forefront of modern medicine has its drawbacks. Over a dozen of these companies have received letters from the states of New York and California in the last few months informing them that they failed to meet certain testing requirements and that now a doctor would be required to order up and deliver the results. Most of the companies are defying the letters. David Magnus is a professor at the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
How much evidence is there that customers are actually being misinformed?
Well, I think it's too early at this point to know whether or not there's actually errors in the information that's being provided. But in terms of being misinformed, I think there's pretty good evidence that the tests are misunderstood. And that can be seen even from the media coverage of the advent of these companies. It was clear that the science reporters, who are actually fairly sophisticated compared to the general public, misunderstood the nature of what the tests really provided in terms of information.
Okay, so we'll leave the accuracy of the information aside for a moment. Let's start first with how the media misreported the story, in your view.
One of the stories was a very moving account by a reporter whose grandfather had died of a heart attack at 65, and his father had had a heart attack at 65, and he was certainly concerned that he might be at risk. And he was surprised and pleased to find out that for the five or six different genes that had been identified in this test that were associated with cardiovascular disease, he actually had below average risk for virtually all of them. It looked to him like he probably was not at risk. The problem with that is that most of the genes that are identified through a genomic process as opposed to a genetic process through something called genome-wide association studies collectively probably don't really matter very much to his risk of heart disease. And probably the family history and the fact that his father and grandfather both had heart attacks at 65 is probably far more predictive than anything you're going to find from a genome-wide association study at the present time.
And did he misunderstand those findings because he was misled by the gene testing organization he got the findings from?
I think it's just hard when you use the language of genetics and the language of genes. What's happened now is there are new techniques that make it possible to identify genetic contributions that are causally very, very minor in how much they contribute to a trait. That's a very new development, and it's hard because people are taking the mental framework that we've got for thinking about the Mendelian genetic traits and just assuming that we can apply it in a straightforward way to the new findings as a result of genome-wide association studies. And I've seen that over and over again in almost all of the coverage of different new genes that have been identified in this new way.
I see that there is a problem here in education, but do you think the solution then is to place a doctor between a person and their genetic information?
Yes, I do. In general, and in fact, here in California, it's not that there's a special requirement for genetic testing. It's that if you're going to have complex medical testing of any sort, you have to have a physician order that test. There are risks of misunderstanding which could harm patients. A cholesterol test or a bilirubin test or a CBC or any of a number of kinds of tests that can only be done by a physician.
On the other hand, there may be good reason to say that all those tests should be taken out of the control of a doctor's order, and that people ought to have more access to that information and be given credit for taking responsibility for their own health. Patients still have a fundamental right to information, no matter how recklessly or irresponsibly they might use it.
Well, they have a right to that information, but that's not the same as saying they have a right to get it in an unencumbered fashion.
It is the same as saying that. Why should the medical establishment stop me from information about me?
It's about making sure that you understand and that there's adequate informed consent for what you're getting so that we can avoid harm. In the story that the reporter wrote about cardiovascular disease, if because of his misunderstanding, he starts thinking he doesn't have to worry about his diet and his exercise and has a heart attack at a much younger age because he misunderstood that information, that is very clearly a direct harm that's a function of the genetic testing.
I understand the risk, I do, but the harm comes from the action he takes based on that information. The government and companies and all sorts of interests around the world frequently say that certain kinds of information could harm us because of the actions we could take, regardless of whether the information is true or false. I'm afraid that in the case of my own medical information, in which the only real victim is likely to be me if I take ill-advised action, that if a physician says that he or she deems it unnecessary for me to take such a test, then I don't get access to it.
Well, what we're saying is not that you can't get access to it, but that you need to have a physician involved. If you get to the point where there's generally understood standards and people start to understand the information pretty well, you start to have a clear understanding of what the harms are, you have a clear understanding of the efficacy of the test for different traits. When you get to that point, that's when you tend to allow things to go over the counter or direct to consumer. But you don't start that way.
How often do you get cranks like me who are really hung up on the freedom of information issue?
Oh, I would say that you're probably in a majority view, but not so much from the freedom of information perspective so much as the free market arguments. There's a lot of people who don't like the idea that there could be anything that would stop the ability of turning genomics into the next big area for Google or something. And so I think there's a lot of concerns that having physicians play a role. And there's a lot of people who are worried that if people really understood more about genomics, we wouldn't probably have much of a debate because nobody would want these tests.
David Magnus, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Magnus is a professor at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. often talk about how new media, the unbounded vistas of cyberspace, can change how we form opinions and communities, how we understand the world. But the internet doesn't change how you write a novel or compose an opera or build a house, right? Actually, it can, if you let it. It can change everything, even practices considered fundamental and immutable, like how we do science. The scientific method is built around testable hypotheses, experiments that confirm or reject theoretical models of how the world works. This, writes Wired editor Chris Anderson in a recent issue of his magazine, is the way science has worked for hundreds of years. But now, new media is making the old scientific method obsolete. Chris, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here.
Before I go any further, just confirm that I have that right.
You have accurately recounted what my article said. And at this point, I need to make a slight confession as a magazine editor that we sometimes pump up our headlines and sometimes engage in a little overstatement for effect. So let me just take all of that and delete the word obsolete. I think what we have is a new way to do science, which adds an option that wasn't available before the ages of massive data and what we call petabyte scale computing. We have, in a sense, a new scientific tool like a microscope or a telescope, which in a sense challenges the form that you just described, which is theory, then experiment.
Well, let's talk about that challenge, despite the fact that I'm nearly apoplectic that you have backed away from your headline, thus depriving me of the ability to hoist you on your own petard. But nevertheless, as you say, we have entered the age of the petabyte, and it would be useful, I think, if you gave us a sense of scale. Mathematician Martin Wattenberg observed in Wired that the sum total of all the words you'll hear in your lifetime amount to less than a terabyte of text. So then how much is a petabyte?
A petabyte is, mathematically, it is, you know, 1,000 terabytes. But we have a hard time understanding that scale. We usually use the sort of, you know, the Library of Congress as an example. The Library of Congress is sort of, you know, on the, you know, a couple terabytes scale. Petabytes, 1,000 of those. We've never seen petabyte scale data aggregations before. There's never been anything like that because we're still relatively early in the, you know, the digital age. But Google has just hit that state. Google processes about a petabyte of information every 72 minutes. And a year from now, it'll process a petabyte every half an hour and so on.
So then connect the dots for us and explain how that volume of data can eliminate the need for the traditional scientific method.
You know, the old way of understanding who we are and what we do was to use kind of conventional human techniques, what's called semantic analysis. So the old form of search, for example, was to try to understand, you know, what is this page about? And Google sort of said, give up. That, you know, you could do that once or twice, but it doesn't scale to the huge volume of the internet. The way PageRank works is they say, we don't know anything about this page, but we do know that these other sites linked to it. So what they're saying is, there is a connection between this site and these highly ranked sites. And those sites are connected to those other sites. And what we have here is correlation, but we don't know anything about causation. We don't know why they link to each other.
But how do we apply this notion that correlation can replace theory in other spheres besides search engines? Give me an example.
One of the best examples is genetics. In the same way that the internet has taken human knowledge and digitized it into a volume that Google treats a huge statistical database, gene sequencing is taking biology, taking the life, taking the world around us and digitizing that. Scientists like Craig Venter, the biologist, are sequencing the oceans. They're sequencing the air. Now, what does that actually mean? And that what it means is you take a sample of a bucket of water or a sample of air and you just sort of throw it in the machines, and what you get is millions or trillions or petabytes of just individual sequences. Now, this is a mashup of all the animals, you know, bacteria, et cetera, that were in that bucket of water, or all the various viruses and things like that that would just happen to be flying through the air. And there's no way to analyze it the way a traditional biologist would. Traditional biologists would be, well, let's look at the animal. Let's look at it under a microscope. Let's, you know, dissect it, et cetera. This new one says, we don't know what it looks like. We don't know how it lives. We don't know anything about it except for that it has a unique sequence of genes, and that popped up as a blip in our statistical view of biology. Now, this is very unsatisfying to us as people. We intuitively are built around stories. Before science came mythology. You know, you looked up in the stars and you invented stories, you know, the constellations, the gods, etc. Those were the stories we used to explain nature. As we got better with our analytical tools, we didn't need those stories. We had theories. Now we're at that stage where our theories really don't explain biology in its fullest. Our theories really can't explain physics in its fullest. We're now, what is a string theory? What are the grand unified theories? We really don't have the experiments that we can do to test these theories. They're just math. They're just abstract. In the case of biology, what we do have is an extraordinary volume of data. And now some biologists like Craig Venter can sort of think like Google does and say, okay, I will not understand how this species evolved. I won't understand how this species lived, but I can use supercomputers and petabyte-scale databases to actually identify them as species, to count them as species, to maybe find some connection between species and say, these two distinct blips seem to both use photosynthesis. I mean, I wonder what that tells us. Or these two distinct blips seem to have a connection to some blips that I found in China in a rice paddy. I wonder why that is. And so you end up thinking abstractly and statistically and not like traditional science and human does. But by doing so, you can scale to an entirely new class of scientific questions that can be answered by data alone.
Genetics seems to be essentially mathematics, whereas psychology is not. And yet you say if we have enough data about how humans behave in a particular way, we don't have to know why. Can you give me an example of that?
Sure. So you say psychology wouldn't lend itself to this approach. Well, let me ask a question. Would you consider behavioral economics a form of psychology? I mean, markets are nothing but millions of people acting out of personal interest involving their own psychology. We're all different. The reality is that you can understand one person maybe. Can you understand everybody simultaneously? No. But what you can do is you can measure their actions. And, you know, behavioral economics applied to market theory on a kind of, you know, a NASDAQ scale is essentially the Google method at work. Obviously, the traditional scientific method is ideal. Newton's laws, you know, quantum mechanics, Darwin's theories are fantastic, and they got us where we are today. And they cut through a lot of confusing data and gave an explanation that did have predictable power. But they all reached their limits.
But if we had petabytes of data back then, are you saying we really wouldn't have needed those theories?
Those petabytes of data might have helped us get those theories more quickly. I mean, obviously, it's hard to imagine what petabytes of data in Darwin's age would have meant. but the point is that he did use data to help develop his theories. I mean, remember, Darwin was not considered a scientist for the first part of his career. He was a naturalist. He was collecting specimens and categorizing them. And so in a sense, what we're doing is we're returning to the earlier stage of science where scientists were data collectors. And the world is too complex in general for ultimately granular understanding of how it works. And that's why we increasingly fall back on statistical methods that use our ability to gather data on an unprecedented scale and then just treat it as a math exercise. We don't start with, you know, the requirement that we understand what's going on in every element. We start with the fact that we have data. And then we statistically analyze the data, and out of that data comes correlations. And at that point, it's enough. Correlation is enough. Causation someday will come. Theory someday will follow. But the notion of data-led science as opposed to theory-led science is the new model that's increasingly being explored.
We don't have a widely accepted unified field theory yet. We don't even know what the universe is made of. We don't know what makes us and dolphins and elephants and a couple of great apes self-aware. Does this Google model know?
The Google model does not know, and the Google model maybe can't know. But what the Google model might be able to do is to allow us to act in the absence of knowledge. And I think we now have a question. What are we going to do with that? When you have access to infinite amounts of data and infinite amounts of processing power, how are you going to use it? How are you going to change the way you ask questions and the way you look for answers? How are you going to think like Google with this unprecedented opportunity to ask questions in a new way?
Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chris Anderson is the editor of Wired Magazine.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh, Aaron Cohen, Wayne Schulmeister, and Paul Schneider. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.